There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Oh, hello! Didn't see you there. You just caught Mike and me starting out a brand new series. We're going to be choosing a random year and discussing the top grossing and the biggest bomb of that year. We're calling it Tops and Bottoms.
Whee!
Mike chose the name.
Yes.
Don't get why people keep giggling when I tell them, but we're starting off with 1959, which, according to Al Stewart, was a bad year for labor and a good year for wine. Ain't that true? Okay. The biggest hit of 59 was Ben-Hur, A Story of the Chris. Not sure about the second bit. I don't think there's anyone named Chris in the movie, but whatever.
Chrisus, maybe?
Maybe. This is a lengthy movie with lots to talk about, so let's get going. I'm your host, Max, you damn dirty ape, Levine. And over there is your host, Pry It From My Cold Dead Hands Loose. Let's get this chariot race going, Mike.
Yeah, I'm stuck in the chariot because I can't seem to poop.
What's wrong with your jaw, Mike? Loosen your jaw.
I have Heston syndrome.
Oh, I'm so sorry. What, did you eat 45 pounds of cheese?
Apparently.
Haven't taken a
Speaking
poop in a month.
45 pounds of cheese, we need to get on to Ben-Hur. But first.
But first, we have our
poll question.
We wanted to know, what movie really, really needs a remake? Dave says, I don't think I can name a remake that I prefer to the original. That's not quite what we asked, but I guess the exception is when I view a literary work that is too complex for film. So I'm happy to see any number of remakes of great works, but they're more like a new take on a familiar story. I don't think there's enough Shakespeare on film. So make more Shakespeare.
What?
You heard him. Let's go make more Shakespeare.
I pretty much think that since there's been film, they've been making filmed versions of Shakespeare.
Yeah, but it's true. They do tend to do about the same six.
Well, those are the good ones.
Well, yeah. I think we need one of Cymbeline or...
Joni Loves Chachi?
Excuse me, that's Jonibus Loves Chachis.
Oh.
Yeah. But okay, thanks, Dave. Sure. We'll go make more Shakespeare. Brian Mundo says... Definitely not Spider-Man or Superman or Batman or any of those overdone superheroes.
Yeah.
Mike actually called him on, okay, those are the ones you don't want to see. What do you want to see? Avatar The Last Airbender by M. Night Dingalong.
Yeah.
That movie was so bad, I had stricken it from my memory until just now.
And it's
sorry
so dark.
We brought it back. Yeah. And... Famous Tatum inventor Richard Tatum says...
Mine's sharp.
Howard the Duck.
What?
Oh. No. The original comic was a hilarious send-up of comic tropes, and now that Marvel has that character in the mix and more developed, and since they didn't need a team of people in awful duck suits anymore, it's time. You know, he's right. The comic book is really good. The comic book was hilarious... The problem is it's a very big inside joke for a lot of Marvel.
Oh, that's not the big problem. The big problem is that he's a duck.
What?
Yeah.
Yes, but I'd follow him into hell.
Did you see it in the theaters? I know I did.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
It was so painful.
I remember just sitting there going, George Lucas, why?
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 Yeah. Okay.
But I think that's a good idea. Thank you, Richard.
I mean, it couldn't be made any worse.
Keith Wright, like Richard, part of the second greatest podcast in all of existence.
Which is?
Line. Oh. No, Cue Footsteps. Says, Blackula.
Oh.
I want another black vampire lead besides Blade.
Yeah.
They did a remake of Blade. No, they didn't. But I don't know if it's ever going to come out. No. They set it up at the end of the Eternals. And you know who they were going to have?
No.
Mahershala Ali as Blade. Would that not have been amazing?
Yeah. I'll watch him in a Weetabix commercial. I don't care.
I thought Wesley Snipes was great as Blade. I think this could match or exceed it.
Remember our episode on Blackula? We actually found some pretty decent story elements to that movie, although it was incredibly low budget.
Yeah.
William Marshall. Oh, I'm so scared.
Yes, he is great. We are great.
Empire.
Charles Forsythe. says The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
could do with a remake by people who understand the source material.
That might be nice.
Yeah, that's fair. The 2005 film was whimsical and missed all of the biting satire that made the book so great. Whimsical. Oh, that is true.
Whimsical.
Why do we say whimsical like
you
that?
You have to. It says in the definition. Whimsical.
Oh, it does. The book is punctuated by moments where Adams has the reader stand back and fully appreciate the absurdity of what's going on by giving a detailed background of what's led up to the present moment. If you just film the events, you miss 90% of the story. This is hard to put on film, but not impossible. It would just take the right screenwriter and director.
Worked on radio.
That's a good point. Yeah. Nick Hoffman says, Captain's courageous. I'm glad they are, but what about the movie? Thank you.
Unfortunately, he'll be here all week.
Yeah, and well beyond. Not because there was anything wrong with the original, but because no one born after 1980 ever saw it. I think he's right.
I've never seen it.
Regan McStravick says, I don't know if I would necessarily call it a remake, but I always thought that Falling Down had a terrific opportunity to be a really good, relevant movie, and that it just missed the mark. Oh, that's that Michael Douglas one about the guy who just has one bad day too many.
There's a traffic jam or something, and he gets out and starts shooting things, or I don't know. I didn't see it.
I don't know if the studio stepped in and decided to make changes to the story to make it be more palatable to audiences. It feels that way to me. But I would love to see that one redone. And that's a good point, although I got to tell you, I think the studios would step in even harder today.
Probably.
Tyler Stewart says, Curse of the Demon and Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell was an interpretation, partial remake, whatever it wasn't good enough.
Oh.
Also, The Devil Rides Out. I guess I'm in a Brit Satanist horror mood today. If I had a nickel.
I know Devil Wears Prada.
I'd have a nickel. thank you, Tyler. Roland, the headless Thompson Gunner Hardy, back again after in Palestine and Berkeley, says, Darkman, one of Raimi's early shoots. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I liked the original.
I didn't get the point. It was supposed to be, I've got this invention. You've invented latex. Big deal. Like, there should have been something more with the whole process of that he invented to change his looks, because I never understood what the big deal was. Because then he ends up turning into that weird guy from, what was it, L.A. Law or something?
Oh, yeah.
Or Dr. Giggles.
Dr. Giggles. And then at the end, it lets him turn into Bruce Campbell.
That's true. His chin grows three times that day.
It was that day. Byron Ho, taking his life in his hands, says, I also think The Fifth Element really needs a remake to be made better, Byron.
Oh, dear. Their home life is going to be interesting.
Oh, dear. He also, seriously says, E-Ragon, for all your online ragged Aragon. Loved the books, but the movie wasn't so good.
Really?
That's polite.
See our entire episode on Aragon.
Byron, I hope you're not suffering without your stone.
I know I am.
Brad Albertson said, Sucker Punch. I'd love to, Brad, but I can't reach him. I loved the movie, but it was not well received. Snyder was also forced to change the movie. I never saw it, but I'd be interested to. And of course, from that remake far to the north, Canada, America's remake.
No.
Yes, it is. At this point, it's an improvement.
Weird. Oh, man. All right, I'm calling up all 40,000 Scotsmen that are in Boston right now. They're coming to your house, and they're tromping your plants.
I don't have enough beer. I don't have enough beer for them.
Nobody does.
They brought the city dry. Sorry, Scotsman. We should have had more beer on hand. I don't know why we didn't.
40,000 Scotsmen can't be wrong.
Yep. I know. I'll challenge them to play tennis. They won't have a chance.
Put on your bed sheet and your blancmange.
I know I'm in a minority when I say this, but I think there is hidden depth inside the movie Reptilicus.
Ba-ba-ba-ba.
Really? A really good giant monster movie. Get rid of the 15 minutes of Tripoli vacation footage and give the monster a really cool modern makeover. I'm not sure if they should keep the sort of romance between the American general and the Swedish guy. Wait, there was a... between the guy or the scientist basically offering his daughters to the male character and they don't seem to mind. But there's definitely something in there that could be used to make either a really crazy movie or just a really interesting one. They should definitely not include the Reptilicus song. They have to include the song.
I was wondering about that part.
They should get Weird Al to do it. Now, Weird Al could do a remake. I think it would work.
Honestly, I would dearly love to hear Weird Al do the Reptilicus song, because I saw the movie when I was a kid and I didn't know they'd cut a song out. And boy, am I glad they did.
Yes, that was a good choice on their part. And from across the seas in the Emerald Isle, Beelolading says, Frank Capra's It Happened One Night deserves a remake. What? Okay, hang on, I gotta hear this. Bill's usually pretty sharp. It's the original rom-com. Everything in romantic cinema subsequent owes thanks to IHON. Oh, that's cute.
Huh? Oh.
It Happened One Night. Okay. Anyone who loves cinema needs to see it. That is absolutely true. No. It feels so modern. Well, except for the whole, oh no, we can't have sex, we're not married. Colbert and Gable are amazing together.
Stephen Colbert's in that?
Yeah, and he's terrific.
Wow, okay.
That's right. And Betty Grable.
Ooh, seven Betty Grables?
Their dual Oscar wins are well-deserved, along with Best Director and Film, the first ever quadruple win.
Oh.
And one of only three in history. Huh. Colbert is an insulated and spoiled society lady. Today's audience would easily accept her as a Kardashian or a Schitt's Creek Rose family member. There's a deeper. Gable is a gumshoe reporter looking for scandal and flash. He'd be with TMZ today. The writing is snappy and fresh, and the story, dialogue, and situations are surprisingly brusque for their time. This was before Hollywood's self-censorship error took hold. Oh, the Hays Code. You really get a sense of place and time, the extreme poverty and want of the Great Depression, but also the lingering aftertaste slash lost glamour of the Anything Goes 20s. A remake still set in the 1930s would be great fun and would be provocative in our own strained times. One of the challenges of It Happened One Night is it appears old. People may be disinclined unfairly from seeing it. Let's give them a refresh. The threat of want at home, the threat of fascism on the horizon, and a tableau of America, I guess, as the two strangers turned lovers ride the night bus from Miami to New York. The soundtrack, the dancing, the similarities to today. I love it. I'd see it twice. No casting recommendations. I want to see two new ingenue actors make their names with this flick. That's my vote.
Huh. Didn't they remake that once with Marlo Thomas and Wayne Rogers?
You're thinking of
It's a Wonderful Life.
That's the one. It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah.
It's same thing.
Yeah. Huh. I don't know. That's pretty provocative.
Huh. I don't think setting in the 30s would work at all, quite honestly. I don't think, unless it's like war-based, I just don't think people are interested in the time period on its own. I will admit, too, and I'm going to get crap from this. Let's see if we get email next week. No. I've never seen it.
Are you sure?
Yes, I have never seen It Happen One Night. It's on the same shelf with Pretty Woman.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Sorry. The only Clark Gable movie I've ever seen is the big one, King Kong.
Right? Episode 121.
We did not watch this.
We did.
I totally remember nothing about it. I've never seen it.
Oh, that's sad. That's very sad.
We did this?
This was from our series number 16, Isn't It Romantic?
Really?
Yep.
Huh. Did we like it?
I kid you not. Yes, we loved it.
Okay.
You decided to sell all your possessions and give them to the descendants of Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert.
Okay. Fine. Good answer, Bill.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Oh, please, you remember every episode we've ever done.
Who are you?
It's called hair, Max. It's called hair.
Oh.
Thank you, Bill.
It. Get rid of it. Yep, thanks, Mr. O'Lading. And, here.
Hang on, let me get some real cream in my hair.
And
Max, it doesn't go on your face.
But it makes my skin so shiny and smooth. It's... Another one from Doris Hempelmeyer.
Hi, Max Mike Movies. Hi, Max. This is Doris Hempelmeyer here to answer your poll question for the week. Well, I was having a hard time with this question because there's so many I never want to see ever remade, and they keep threatening to. No Casablanca, right? But then I got to thinking, there's a lot of movies out there that were very badly cast. I mean, like... white people playing not white roles. So I'm going to put out there for you Breakfast at Tiffany's and A Majority of One. I think that if you put the actual actors who are of that background in those particular troublesome roles, I think we could have some really good movies. What do you guys think? Anyway, that's my answer. I hope you guys have a wonderful week. I'll see you later, Max. Bye.
Okay. Well, first off, I can definitely see replacing Mickey Rooney in that in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Or
yes.
Removing that part entirely.
Entirely, yeah. You get some other loud neighbor.
I don't know.
Huh.
I have a hard time with that movie. I do not like that movie because I do not like what they do to the Audrey Hepburn character. I like her without George Peppard just fine, thank you very much. I don't like this Taming of the Shrew crap.
Yeah, I also, it's a hell of a reach to try to redo an Audrey Hepburn role.
Yeah.
Most of the time, they're smart enough not to try that.
I also was just weirded out. It's like, wait, she came from the Beverly Hillbillies? Really? Because like, I was not
That's
prepared
right.
for that.
Uncle Jed came to claim her. Yep. She was from Bug Tussle.
Take her out to the cement pond. Okay.
Yep.
But, well, we like
okay,
the answer.
Okay, but thank you, Doris. Yeah. Yeah.
But what about you, Max? Ha ha!
What about me? Oh, Kirsch. You know, I got a couple.
Yeah.
I would actually like to see a remake of The Dunwich Horror.
Oh, I've never seen it.
Yes.
Is that Yog-Sothoth?
Yog-Sothoth.
Okay, yes, it is.
It's a terrible, terrible movie, but it's an interesting Lovecraft story, and I think someone could do it a lot better.
I think it's safe to
say
preferably
without the Yoda ears.
I think it's safe to say you could probably remake any Lovecraft film. I don't think there's been any good
there
ones.
There have not been a lot of good ones. I mean, From Beyond, I suppose,
well,
is technically a love. Sort of a Lovecraft.
I enjoy
movie.
From Beyond very much. Calling it a good film, that's a stretch.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hey, any of you out there, are there any good Lovecraft films?
Yeah,
I'd like to know.
Good ones.
The other one I'd like to see is a remake of The Conqueror. I'd actually like to see a movie about Genghis Khan, maybe actually played by Asian actors and with no radiation poisoning.
Sure. I mean,
I think it could work.
I don't think it'd be as funny.
Oh, it wouldn't be nearly as funny.
Hopefully not as boring.
I have returned, my mother.
Yeah, see our entire episode. Just see our episode because that way you don't have to watch the movie.
Please don't watch the movie.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? What would you like to see remade? What movie cries out for it?
Well, what's interesting is that I have a clue, a visual clue, nobody else can see it, is your background. I would like them to remake the Star Wars prequels. They suck.
Oh,
I'm sorry,
yeah.
But the whole arc of Anakin Skywalker does not work. His motivation makes no sense. There is no pathos. There is no acting. And it has a unfortunate connection to this week's film.
Yes, it does.
So
I'd like to see all three of those.
Yeah, like somebody else make them, please, and rewrite them. Like just literally scrap everything. They don't have to in any way resemble.
Lock George Lucas in a box
and I know
have someone else do it.
That there are younger fans that those were their first Star Wars films and they like them. But they could be done so much better. So
they
much
could.
Better. So, but you know what else can be done better, Max, is a new poll question.
Oh, I think our last one was very good. Yes, I would like another one. When you hear that a movie is a multi-Oscar winner, does that actually influence your desire to see it? And does it do it positively or negatively? And at the end of the show, we will reveal our dark secret of how to contact us. And unfortunately, it does not involve sacrificing 8 squirrels and filling their bodies with acorns.
No, it involves email, Max, but...
Yes.
Before we move on,
I
would like to make an announcement.
Okay.
We have a sad announcement today, and while it's never the aim for Max Mike Movies to add morosity to our podcast, we must relate... Yeah, it's a word. I made it up. We must relate the news that the Bruno Kirby Memorial Fat Suit has passed on. The Fat Suit was last seen in Hollywood enjoying a cup of coffee at the Brown Derby. It spent a fine day frolicking in the grass. The family asks
you make me cry.
I'm sorry, Max. Family asks you to not send flowers or cards at this time. So, yes, the passing of the Bruno Kirby Memorial Fat Suit.
You were taken from us too soon, Bruno Kirby Memorial Fat Suit.
And who would have thought that its origin was The Godfather? But I finally found out where it came from.
I finally found it. Oh, that makes... I always forget he's in the second movie.
But the thing is that it was used, it was given from Bruno Kirby to Christopher Lloyd so he could play Uncle Fester. So that is why we have the Bruno Kirby Memorial Fat Suit.
The mystery has been solved. Yes. You can all sleep at night.
But also, before we move on, I'd just like to throw this in there. And I'm sorry to interrupt Max because he is hosting this week. But we have a new little segment.
Yeah.
And it's called Seen Anything Good. So, Max, seen anything good?
I saw Disclosure Day over the weekend. I thought that was almost good. I thought there were parts of it that were really good. I think the performances were great. I think Emily Blunt should get several Oscars all at once.
Yeah, I'm just She's terrific. And more impressed with her every time I see her.
Yeah, I think everyone in it, all the performances were really good. I'm not crazy about the ending, and I keep feeling we've seen all this before.
I saw it as well. I did not mind the ending. What I minded was there was so much chase and so little that I got to find out about what I was interested in. I think it's a solid Spielberg film, but I don't think it's an outstanding one. So yeah, it's decent. Does it need to be seen in the movie theater? Probably not.
I think it helps. I don't know. I think it helps. Some of the sense of scale in a few scenes, it really does help on the big screen, but yeah.
I've also started watching Spider-Noir, which has our old friend Nicolas Cage as Ben
Reilly.
Ben Reilly, a alternate world version of Spider-Man.
Ben Reilly was the original Spider clone who thought he was Peter Parker but turned out to be a clone, and so he took the name Ben Reilly.
You're hired.
Thank you.
So we saw him in the Spider-Verse animated films, and they decided to make it is heavily, heavily noir. Like, it is leaning really, really heavily on those tropes, but it's having fun with them too. And you get to start seeing these other Spider-Man characters show up. I'm only two episodes in, but I think it's worth a watch, at least those two, if you're looking for something new. So that's what we've seen that's potentially good.
Yeah, cool. There'll be more. But now, facts. Budget.
Here it comes.
$15 million.
Well, I was going to say that's not so bad, but we're talking 1959.
Box office, initial box office in domestic, $75 million.
Wait, is that more?
Yes, that's quite a lot more.
Five times
and
more.
Globally, $146 million.
Oh my God.
If you adjust for inflation, this makes it the 13th highest grossing movie ever.
Only 13th.
Yeah.
Cripes. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we got Ben-Hur-2.
The Hurrening.
So I'm sorry, but I can't pronounce this film any other way but Ben-Hur. Hur.
Well, if we really want to be correct and progressive, it should be Ben, They, Them.
Okay. No.
But it's not going to be. This movie won 11, count them, 11 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Actor, and Supporting Actor.
Wait, which actor won?
Believe it or not, Chuck Heston.
No, I don't. We'll come back to that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is the first of only three movies to have won 11 Academy Awards. You know what the other two are?
Let me see.
Oh, I'm going to guess Best Picture.
Gone with the Wind is one of them?
Nope.
Oh, boy.
That won 8.
That won 8. 11 Oscars?
Well, plus 2 special ones.
I know one of them I'm going to kick myself for. It's like, because how would I not know this? But I'm going to go with I don't know.
I'll give you a hint. I'm going to sink this bitch.
Really?
Titanic.
Okay. I mean, and I like the movie, but 11 Oscars? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well. And the third was Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Really?
Yeah, which is hard to remember because almost, like, one was for Best Picture, all the rest were for, like, the technical stuff, for editing, adapted screenplay.
Hey, 11's 11.
And interestingly, several of the categories that were won by Titanic and the Lord of the Rings didn't exist in Ben-Hur's day.
Fair.
Which actually makes its 11 wins much more impressive.
Mm.
The director, William Wyler, of the famous Fruit Punch.
No.
He also did Roman Holiday, The Best Years of Our Lives, Mrs. Miniver, got an Oscar for that, and Funny Girl.
Oh.
He also coined the famous joke, it took a Jew to make a good film about Jesus.
Well, it's nice to know there was somebody of the Jewish persuasion involved with that film.
there's at least one other.
Oh, we'll get one. To her. Oh, that's nice.
Yes, yes. This is based on the 1880 novel, Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, by General Lew Wallace, who was the former U.S. minister to the Ottoman Empire and governor of New Mexico.
Didn't he also write the Ballad of the Green Berets and then write that whole series of Kafka books?
I think you're thinking of Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler, so no.
Oh, well, you can see why I get them confused.
Not really. Not at all. The book was made into a Broadway play and later into a silent movie in the 20s.
Oh.
In 1900, Ben-Hur became the best-selling American novel of the 19th century, surpassing Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mmm, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yep. The chariot race required 15,000 extras, background actors.
Okay.
On a set constructed on 18 acres of backlot.
Cripes.
At, I'm going to say this wrong, but Cinecittà Studios outside Rome.
Right.
Tour buses visited the set every hour. 18 chariots were built, with about half being used for practice. The race itself took 5 weeks to film and cost about $4 million, or about 25% of the film's budget.
Well, it is like the most memorable and iconic scene of the film.
This scene actually used one of the very few and extremely expensive 65mm cameras in existence, and it was destroyed during the race.
Ah, oops.
Oops, yeah. During the 18-day auction of MGM props, costumes, and memorabilia that took place in May 1970, when new studio owner Kirk Kerkorkian was liquidating the studio's assets, things weren't going well that year, a Sacramento restaurateur bought one of the chariots from the movies for $4,000. 3 years later, during the energy crisis, he was arrested for driving it on the highway. Yep.
Wow. Okay.
The desert sequences were all set to be filmed in Libya until authorities in the country, which for those of you who don't know, is a Muslim nation, realized that the film was promoting Christianity. So the government ordered MGM out of the country, forcing the studio to shift filming to Spain, which has the only desert in Europe.
Hmm.
This is the only Hollywood film to make the Vatican-approved film list in the category of religion.
Oh.
Jesus Christ shows up in this a few times.
Sort of.
The back of his head, his hands. You never see his face. And he is played by American opera singer, because God knows you needed an opera singer for a non-speaking role, Claude Heater, who went uncredited in his only feature film role because he never spoke. Yeah, he was born in Oakland, California, just like Jesus. If you're interested in the wager that the Sheik makes with Masala involving talents, Sheik. 1,000 talents, yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
A talent was a measure of weight and could have meant either silver or gold, as each metal was measured in talents. In 2022 dollars, the sum wagered by Masala against the Sheik at 4-1 odds, so 1,000 talents, if it was silver, that'd be about $82 million. And if it was gold, $8
billion. Well,
big bet.
A lot of money to throw in a goddamn golf swing.
Yeah, yeah. Golf swing? It's the horsies.
It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon. What the hell else have we got to do? Sorry, that's Thomas Crown.
Ah. The 10-square block set that represents Jerusalem is historically accurate. They did a lot of research.
Yay.
Stephen Boyd had to wear lifts in his sandals or whatever to make his height closer to Charlton Heston's. Martha Scott, who plays Judah Ben-Hur's mother, or Charlton Heston's mother, was 45 at the time, which makes her 10 years older than Charlton Heston.
Yeah, we'll come back to her.
I know they had kids young, but she also played his mother, Yochebed, in the Ten Commandments 3 years earlier.
Oh, dear gods, did she?
Yep. Okay. Yes, she did. Charlton Heston actually had learned how to handle a two-horse chariot when he was making the Ten Commandments. When he arrived in Rome, he instantly began lessons in four-horse chariot racing with the film stunt coordinator Yakima Canutt. You know,
yes.
Yakima, I never miss a Yakima Canutt film. The 300 sets built required 5 years of research and 14 months of labor. During filming, director William Wilder noticed that one of the extras was missing a hand. He had the makeup department construct a prosthetic that included a protruding false bone to cover the stump for the scene in the galley.
Yeah.
Wilder did the same thing with an extra who's missing a foot.
Ah.
An infirmary was built specifically for the filming of the chariot race scenes. However, in the end, very few injuries were actually sustained, and most of them were sunburn. Even more incredible, and this really kind of stunned me, despite all the dangerous stunts done with horses, none of the animals died or had any major injuries. In the 1925 version, close to 100 horses died during production.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yuck.
At 2 hours, 1 minute, and 23 seconds, Charlton Heston's performance in this movie is the longest to ever win an Academy Award for Best Actor, and the second longest to win in any category.
Well, we'll
that's something to be proud of.
Chuck.
Chuck. The Roman decurion's line, "No water for him," became the on-set catchphrase for the remainder of the shoot. Whenever anyone made a mistake, one or several actors or crew members would shout out, "No water for him!" I love that. Now, this is one I have never heard this rumor, but it really, well, it kind of makes sense to me. According to Gore Vidal, in an interview in 1995's The Celluloid Closet, Ben-Hur and Masala were former lovers, and Masala betrayed Ben-Hur because their relationship ended. According to Vidal, who claims to have written part of the script, he discussed this with Stephen Boyd, who played Masala, ahead of shooting, but they didn't tell Charlton Heston because they figured he couldn't handle it.
They are probably right, and we will come back to that.
After the interview, Heston vehemently denied that Ben-Hur had any homosexual subtext or that Vidal had any real involvement with writing the script.
Oh, boy.
Vidal responded by quoting extracts from Heston's 1978 autobiography, An Actor's Life, in which Heston admitted that Vidal had written much of the finished screenplay.
Yeah.
There is a ton of other stuff. This movie has been analyzed. It's been written about, but we'd be here all day. So besides speaking of getting to all day, we got to talk about the plot.
Oh, yeah, right, that.
Our story begins in Bethlehem, sometime around Hanukkah. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And a mighty Kleeglite led them and three wise men to a manger where a calf jumped around. And that's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. No, while Jeebus does in fact start the movie and make several non-speaking appearances in it, this is the story of Prince Judah Ben-Hur, played by noted Gentile Charlton Heston and his chin. Judah is a rich, respected prince in Judea. That's good! But Judea is under the heel of Rome. That's bad. But Judah's old friend, Masala, has come home as second in command of Judea. That's good! But Masala wants Judah to narc on any grumpy Gus Jews who maybe aren't nuts about Rome. That's bad. Okay, enough of that. Masala throws a hissy fit when Judah points out that snitches get stitches, and through some very unwacky hijinks, gets Judah condemned as a galley slave, and his mother and sister, Charltonina and Charltonette, thrown in prison. Judah has nothing left but his hatred of Marsala and his chin. Grr. Through sheer Hestonosity, he survives the galleys, rescues a powerful Roman, gets adopted by this Roman, meets an Arab sheikh played by a Welshman, has the most famous chariot race in cinematic history, finds out that his mother and sister have become lepers, and still finds time to run into Jeebus himself several times, including at the Sermon on the Mount and the Crucifixion. Jeebus uses his magic powers to cure Judah's family for some reason. Judah gets the girl, and everything is wonderful for the Jews forever after that. The end.
The film.
Ah, thank you. So, Mike.
So, Max.
Have you?
Well, go ahead. You're her hosting.
Yep. Have you ever seen this movie before?
Nope. I've seen The Chariot Race because everybody is required to that was born between 1960 and 1999. You were required by law to see The Chariot Race. Or you didn't have to watch the rest of the film.
Nope, just The Chariot Race.
So, no, have not seen it. Didn't really know anything about it. How about you?
I have seen parts of it because this movie is over 3.5 hours long.
Holy crap, is it?
I've come across it on TV many times, and I'll watch a few scenes and then change the channel. I had never seen the whole thing from beginning to end.
Yeah, and now we have. Did you pause for the intermission?
No, and I did fast forward to the 6-minute overture.
6:34.
Oh, excuse me.
I did. I was clinging for the... I actually looked it up while I was watching. Please be an intermission. Please be an intermission. And they told me when it was. And the time they told me it was not when it was. It was about 5 minutes after that. So I was like, oh, please, I hope you didn't cut it out. No, they didn't. So I clung on to it. It's like, I need a nap. So I had lunch, took a nap, and came back to it. So,
Yep.
It's long. Speaking of long, why don't we talk about the cast,
which
I think we should really cut off after a certain point because people didn't have a lot of parts and we only have so much time.
There's a lot of people in this movie. Yeah. Well, we got to start off with Charlton I Love Guns Heston. Judah Ben. Who told him he could play Jews? Moses.
I don't know, but they told him twice.
Ay, ay, ay.
One of my notes is Charlton Heston can overact without even speaking.
Yes. Yes, he can.
Oh, my God. His facial expressions, you swear he just ate an iron ingot, and now it has to come out. Mm-hmm. And there's only one way it can come out, and that is if he contorts his face hard enough, it might shoot out the poop, and there you go.
I swear, I really wonder about Charlton Heston's GI tract sometimes, and there's no other actor on earth I would say that about.
I'm going to ask you this. Have you ever seen a performance of Charlton Heston that you thought was good?
Yes. I have seen
You told me this once, and I was like, really? Isn't it like Shakespeare or something?
It is in Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. He's in one scene where Charlton Heston plays the chief of the strolling players, and he does the Hecuba speech. Not Harold.
Harold Hecuba?
No. See, I knew that was coming. And he, first of all, I'm going, oh, wow, somebody got him a lot of X-lax. He opens his mouth the whole way. I've never seen that before. So I think that he does a really good performance in that. And honestly, in Wayne's World 2, when he, you know the one I mean?
No.
Yeah. Yes, you do.
Wayne's World 2. Yep. I forgot he was in that.
Yeah, well, he's in like 30 seconds where some guy in a guest.
That's all you need.
That really is. And he actually does a fairly decent job of delivery in that. So,
does he play a UPS driver? Because it's the only way I can think he could deliver anything well.
No, he does it because in contrast to the guy he replaces, he's much better.
Oh, I remember it now. Okay. I mean,
can we get a better actor for this?
No, apparently.
No.
I do not understand the draw of Charlton Heston. For one thing, no offense, and you don't need to be like this because certainly Humphrey Bogart proved this. You don't have to be a handsome guy to be a good actor. But Charlton Heston's face is weird, and they keep doing close-ups on it, and I don't, like, there's not a particular, like, three-quarters slightly smiling with the sun behind him, he's not too bad, but otherwise it's just like, he is an odd-looking person.
His mouth is very strange, but people thought he looked rugged.
He's just so over the top, and he proves that in this film. He's like the silent actor that couldn't quite make the transition to sound, right? The same kind of over, like, oh my God, the anguish. I do not a fan of his performance in this.
I've enjoyed him in some things, but in this, I don't know, he's very hammy.
Yeah.
Which, playing a Jew is just really inappropriate. Jack Hawkins as Quintus Arius.
Well, he's there for 5 minutes.
Yeah, he's briefly on, and his is a fairly understated performance. As the first Roman nihilist.
Sure. He's fine.
He's fine. And we got to the main thing, the big villain, Stephen Boyd.
Yeah.
As Messala. Apparently for this movie, he grew a really thick, bushy beard because he thought that's what people had until he was told that Romans of that time were clean shaven. Had to cut the whole thing off. He also has blue eyes, being from Ireland. And they
does Heston.
Yeah, but they made him wear brown contacts that actually hurt him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Again, he is. I don't think he's terribly subtle. I mean, without the beard, he just needs the mustache to twirl.
I know, but when he and Charlton Heston first show up, I'm like, wow, there are some serious sparks going on here. Really, like
my first note is, just kiss already.
Really? I understand why they didn't tell Heston, and now that you tell me that, there are a couple of scenes where his eyes kind of widened like, what are you doing? Yeah. But those two, they used to romp in the hay. I'm sorry, they did. And if Heston didn't like it, too bad. I don't care. Yeah. As far as a villain goes, he's fine. I mean, he's overplaying it the same way, not as much, but overplaying the same way that Heston is. And quite honestly, the way that they did in Ten Commandments. So... Yeah. He fits the film, I guess.
Now we have Haya Harit as Esther, the love interest. And she, by the way, is the one actual Jew in the major characters. Well, she was born in, technically it was not Israel then, she was born in Palestine.
Was Sam Jaffe not Jewish? Because I thought he was.
Oh, I think he might be, but he's a fairly minor character. But yes, he is.
Well, no, she's not. Yeah. She's as close to, yeah. Well, it's nice that they had at least one or
two.
Two.
Yeah.
Because in this movie about Jewish people, it's nice that there are some.
Yeah.
But now we have to get to the...
But wait, that's not all she is. I think she does a nice job. Okay. I think she's got good intensity. Her chemistry with Charlton Heston is okay. Well, it's supposed to be very smoldering and sort of long, hidden passion. And it's kind of like, oh, really? Okay.
Well, my note when they're together for the first time is, oh, the smoldering averageness when Charlton and Nehea kiss. It's, yeah.
Oh, you're so, so suitable.
But
we got Sheik Ilderim, played by Hugh Griffith, the man from face Wales. Paint, that's being generous. It's shoe polish.
Not only that, but it's not consistent. No, sometimes it's lighter. Sometimes he rubs it off.
You got to understand, part of that is the high definition. Back then, it wasn't as noticeable. But now you can see a very sharp makeup line on his forehead right before the turban.
Sometimes.
The burnous,
excuse me. And sometimes he's darker, and it's like... Wow.
Other than that, I really like him. I like his performance. He's got so much energy, and he's clearly having a lot of fun. And I'm sorry, it's really nice to see this Arab and the Jew getting along, even though they're not Arabs or Jews.
No. The Welshman and the American from wherever. Mm. I don't know where the Hestons come from, but hopefully they've sprayed for Hestons.
Apparently they come from a planet where apes evolved from men.
Yeah, and they don't poop.
Nope.
They just explode when they're 15.
We got Martha Scott as Miriam.
Do you recognize her?
I don't. I know I should. I know she was
in... Oh, you should. She played Bob Newhart's mom on the Bob Newhart show.
Okay, I don't feel quite as bad about that, because isn't she only in one episode?
No, she's in like half a dozen. She shows up a number of times, and she was in one episode of Columbo. She is delightful as Martha Hartley in that show. And she's right across one of your personal friends, Bernard Hughes.
Ah, my old pal, Bernard Hughes.
Because he plays Bob's dad.
He's dad, so. Yep.
Yeah, she's fine.
She does a good job. She isn't in there much. I do think the scenes toward the end when she and her daughter have contracted leprosy.
Sure. Yeah, we'll come back to that because...
Yeah, I think she does a very good job of portraying the tragedy and the pain.
Yeah, except when you finally see the makeup, it's like, oh, honey, you have a little smudge there. You might want to...
Yeah, I got to say, that is the nicest looking case of leprosy I've ever seen.
Who else do you want to mention? Because we don't need to go through all of these people.
No, I am so kind of surprised by the way they portrayed Pontius Pilate.
You mean as a gay man?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, he actually comes
Pontius
across...
and the Angry Inch.
What?
Sorry, it's a deeper.
I know. You're talking about Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Is Frank Thring in that?
No, but I
didn't think so.
You're waiting for him to just start singing, aren't you? He seems like he's about
to burst
into song.
He does look like he's about to burst into song at several points. But he's actually portrayed as fairly reasonable. He's this horrendous villain. But when he's talking about, look, this is the way the world is. Rome's in charge for now.
Either that or with that voice, he's about to try to sell you some Nine Lives cat food. He's fine, but I'm sorry. It's like when, what's his name shows up in Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's like, okay, yeah, we know you're gay. The Imperious Leader, whatever his name was.
Yeah, yeah.
Bunny Beckinridge. Why do I remember these things? Mr. Bunny, I heard you becoming a lady. Speaking of which, there's an actor in here I swore was Tor Johnson, and it's not.
It's not. You're talking about Malthus or Malka.
Yeah.
Malak, that was it. The unspeaking giant who is I wish I'd seen more about them, you know, because Simonides, Sam Jaffe, who is the steward of the house of Ben-Hur, he gets tortured. He can't walk, so he has this incredibly big mute carry him
time
around.
For go to bed.
He must have been the tallest one in your class.
Yeah. I guess the only other person I'd bring up is Terrence Longdon as Drusus, otherwise known as Messala's second lover. Oops. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's right. Messala's
those two are making
rebound.
He gets so jealous when Ben-Hur shows up. He's like,
Yes. And by the way, there's no lack of nearly naked, sweaty men in this movie.
I mean, it's not quite as bad as Top Cappy, but it's kind of close.
Yeah.
See our episode a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, there's a cast of mostly people I'd never heard of, which was interesting. I thought that was interesting. So one thing surprised me when this popped up, besides the overture, the last time I saw the overture used in a film was 1990s Disney film, The Prince and the Pauper. They actually had an opening short cartoon, and then they had a little overture and a little countdown for like 10 minutes. But we don't get those anymore. Do you miss them?
Not really. I mean, I certainly don't miss them on streaming. I don't see the point. That's what the pause button is for.
Yeah, I skip
in the movie theaters, the only thing I could see is it gives you a chance to find your seat and then go out and get popcorn and come back, or use the bathroom and come back.
Well, that's what the previews are for, or the ads. So something weird is an MGM film. Did you notice something weird about the MGM opening?
Yeah, the lion doesn't move.
He doesn't roar. There's no roar.
Oh, I missed that.
At all.
Okay.
I was just like, the lion roaring. It's all he does. You cut his line. So
they didn't want to pay him.
Did you watch this on a service of some sort?
Yeah, I did. I watched it on
Man, what a gorgeous print.
It is beautiful. They have really done everything they can to maintain and restore this film. And I understand why. I mean, this thing is cinematic history.
Yeah, it's gorgeously shot. It's so beautiful. Much color. All the color. And you know what it made me realize, because I saw this, of course, I saw it the same day I went to go see Disclosure Day. And Disclosure Day leans way into that blue-gray palette that is very common these days.
Yeah, that's
annoying. And part of me is like, you know, I kind of miss color.
Yeah. Yeah, I miss that too. And it's so beautiful.
But we start off with the birth of Jeebus. And all I could think of was, that's no star. That's a space station.
It looks like a Klieg light because it's like shining a spotlight down on the manger. Well, also, I got to say, there is a detail that I could not help but notice.
Yeah.
The calf that you see, which is also symbolizing the birth of
the
a baby.
The one that nearly kicks Jeebus in the head.
Almost murders the Messiah, is a Holstein. The Holstein breed did not exist until 1922. Ruined the movie. Speaking of animals that were not what I expected, did the horses that Ben-Hur chariot drives, did they look a little odd?
They didn't look like Arabians, that's
for
sure.
That's the thing. They're supposed to be these four perfect white Arabians. They were not. They were Lipizzaners.
I'll tell you right now, the one on the right that eventually goes on the inside because he's slowest, it's Bumpy.
You think Bumpy doesn't look that good?
Aren't you a little short for a chariot horse?
Yeah.
No, I could tell because Arabians have a very narrow nose and they call it a dish-shaped face. I don't know why they do that. Yeah, but it's like, those aren't supposed to be Arabians, are they? Because they ain't.
Yeah, they really ain't.
There's two words that I think best describe this film, or at least that it has in abundance. Let's see if you agree. Mm-hmm. Grandeur and pageantry. They're cops.
Yep. Both officers are present and accounted for in this movie. There's a lot of huge scale, whether it's the desert or the circus itself where the chariot race takes place.
The pod race, yeah.
Yes, the pod. You really can see. I bet I could use this.
I'd like to do a pod race that's like the one in Ben-Hur.
But let's be fair. Everybody for the last 60 years who has any kind of a race sequence owes something. The chariot race, it is magnificent.
Well, NASCAR owns its existence to this.
Yes. Yes, pretty much.
You know, people seem to like to watch people turn left. Let's make something out of that. So the pageantry and the grandeur, never mind the budget, I didn't have to do a lot of research, but I did a little research on why they might have been willing to do this. So this was made in 1959, and there was something big going on in the 50s, especially the late 50s, that was really troubling for Hollywood. I'm sure you know what this is.
Rock and roll.
No, but you're sort of close. Television.
Television was McCarthy hearings.
Well, no, but television was taking huge bites out of movie profits because they started showing movies on television, and a lot of people were like, well, why go out to the theater when I can just sit at home and watch it in my box, even though it's in black and white and 1/1,000,000th the size, but it's the same thing. And they were having a lot of trouble. They were losing a lot of profits. And so they started to have to make these big tentpole, big budget, grandeur, epic films to get people out of their seats and go back to the theater. And this was more or less the golden age of television. So there was all sorts of new and interesting stuff going on at home. And that may be one of the reasons.
Wanted something that you really kind of had to see on the big screen.
Yeah. Well, look, yeah. We've asked this question before. Max, I did not see this on a big screen. I saw it at home. Do you think film would have benefited from seeing it in a big theater?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I think I wish I had seen it in a big theater.
Yeah. Well,
that is the way to see this.
I wouldn't have got my nap.
You know, there's another reason that they filmed it in Rome. Not just because they had that was the largest outdoor studio in Europe, but MGM had financial assets in Italy that had been frozen by Mussolini's regime.
Oh.
In World War II, which had not been that long ago. And the government said, we'll release the money, but you got to spend it here.
Oh. Well, to be fair, that's where this is supposed to take place. Yes. So, sure.
Bloody Romans.
Yep. Romans go the home. In general, I think that the pageantry and the grandeur works really well. But then we get to this scene. It's on these galley ships where there's about to be a battle. And my note is, special effects by Billy! Because...
I think the models are very good, but they are very clearly models. You can see, you know, when somebody's hit by a catapult, a ball of Greek fire, you can see the little toy fall over.
But also, it's rare that they actually hit anything. Those catapulters are terrible shots. Yeah. There's all these little fireworks going back and forth, not hitting anything. And it's not necessarily the models, it's the way they're photographed. And the two things that are hardest to photograph in miniature are fire and water, and both of them are there.
Yeah, you said both.
Yep, water beats fire. Anyway, so other than that, obviously the money was very well spent. I don't blame them for, at that point, not building a fleet of ships to actually have a battle, but... Yeah.
I do like the Macedonian pirates. I keep waiting for them. Arr! We're Macedonians! Arr!
Sure.
Because that's how they talked.
Yeah. So,
and when Quintus goes over the side, Quintus Arius, the nasty Roman who Ben-Hur decides to save, all I could think is, quick, get on the door, Rose. I mean, Quintus.
I kept screaming, there's room for both of you.
And there was in this case.
Yeah. Hey, they're connected, though, because 11 Academy Awards each. So, yeah, there's a big connection. So, what would you call the pacing? Do you have a word for the pacing?
Uneven?
Well, but what are the two parts that are balancing or not balancing each other out?
Anytime there's dialogue, anytime there's people standing and talking, things slow way down. Anytime there's actually things happening, I think the pacing's really good.
Like when? The chariot race. Okay.
Not just the chariot race. I thought most of the scenes on the slave galley were really interesting too.
Really?
I think it's really effective when Quintus decides he's going to put them to their paces and goes from, you know, normal speed, attack speed, ramming speed. And he's just watching to see which of them are going to fail. And it kills like two of them.
Yeah. I guess I just pretty much every scene for me in this film went on way too long. And that was one of them. Yeah. It's just like, okay, we're watching him watch these guys row up. Now apparently it's faster. Okay, it's bad. You know, it'd be nice if Charlton actually breathed because I'm not buying this that he's not all that tired. Although I will say, pretty much as the prince, the Jewish prince, it's the only time that he's not greasy. He otherwise spends pretty much the rest of the film all greasy for one reason.
He's very shiny. I don't know.
He's always greasy. I don't get it. But I just thought every scene went on too long. And the other problem is that this film telegraphs every major plot point in the most obvious ways. And so I started making little predictions. Like, as soon as we're watching the Romans come in, you hear the little tiles start to rattle. And it's like, oh, God, the tile's going to fall. And it's going to look like they're trying to hurt the guy and they're going to get arrested. Oh, look, that's what happens. And then in that scene where he's rowing and they're talking, oh, have you ever thought about being a gladiator? Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? I literally wrote, oh, I know what's going to happen. They're going to get in a battle. The ship's going to go down. He's going to save the guy, and that guy's going to bring him back. Oh, look what happened. It happened. And if we're giving away spoilers, come on. 1950.
Yeah.
Every major plot point to me is just telegraphed badly. Like, it's so heavy-handed. And for me, that meant that the direction in general was languid. and obvious.
I got to admit, for a 1959 movie, that doesn't bother me that much. Subtle plotting. I don't think they'd invented it quite yet.
It's not that it wasn't subtle. It's just like they might as well hold up a little card saying plot point, plot point, plot point. Everything was just so obvious. And I'm like, oh, so his mother and his sister, who've been in solitary, somehow get leprosy. That's not how you get leprosy. You actually have to be in contact, actually constant contact with people who have it. So,
Well, the idea is I assume there were other people in the cell who had it and gave it to them.
No, they were alone.
Yeah.
But that's okay because they get leprosy. Oh, I wonder what's going to happen because isn't Jeebus in this movie? I wonder if, well, and of course, luckily, Jeebus knows the area of effect version of cure disease.
I have to admit, in my notes around when he's going down into the pit of the lepers, I have, see my legs, I can hardly walk. My eyes, I can hardly see.
And of course, they don't even like shake hands with him. We just see the back of Jeebus walk by because, you know, that's good enough.
Well, I think part of that is they didn't want to offend because there's the whole graven idol and there's the whole, there are people who think that portraying him visually is offensive.
Well, as long as you do it from a distance or from behind, it's okay, I guess.
Right. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. What did you think about all those appearances of Jeebus showing up, like giving him water in the desert? Which is paralleled later because at the crucifixion, he offers him water.
I didn't see that coming. It was such a surprise. Like, oh, okay. I mean, this... problem is that if I have to look at him, I don't think that Judah Ben-Hur is really all that great a guy.
He's motivated by vengeance.
Right. Well, he says he's not a violent man, but then he's like, oh, I guess I will be in this case. He starts off as this rich Jewish guy who has slaves. Oh, but he's a nice slave owner, so it's okay.
They like him, but come on, that's part of the time period. That was part of the society.
But this is a fictional character. So they made a choice to make him a slave owner. I don't care that he's a nice slave owner. It's like, okay, so you own people. That's not questionable. And then he basically turns his back on everybody at some point, including Jeebus. Although, to be fair, Jeebus only shows his back, so it's easy to turn your back on him because... It's like, even in the end, like, I kind of sit there and go, oh, now he's a good Jew. But, of course, the Jews don't follow Jeebus.
Yeah, well.
So,
well, we were supposed to. We were all supposed to convert.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, was it even called
Christianity? I knew I forgot something this weekend.
So, like, he gets mad at Esther because she lied to him. And it's like, she lied to you because your mother and sister told her to. And, oh, by the way, she's been going down and bringing them food. What have you been doing? When he gets back to town, he says, find out where my mother and sister are. I think I will laze around and sleep tonight. Like, seriously? You're not going to go out, like, searching door to door or something? He sends somebody else out to find. I just don't think he's that great a guy. His adoptive father, who obviously seems to really care for him. I get the impression that the only reason he saved Quintus Arius is like, you know, I can use this guy. And in fact, he won't let the guy commit suicide because he's like, you're not going to die because I need you.
You live to serve the ship, which in that case was, you know, a door or a hunk of wood.
So I don't really care for the character. And also, the name of the film is really Son of Her, right? Because they say that at one point.
Yeah.
So like Son of Kong, it's like that. Could they call it Ben Kong?
Ben of Her Island.
Yep. So Augie Ben Doggy would be Doggy Son of Augie, I guess.
Something like that. Something like that.
So I don't like the character. I don't buy him. And he's like, every time he loses his money, well, thank God the rich person gets their money back because that was close.
Hey, we Jews are very good at hiding money.
Sure, I wasn't even going to go there. I just was like rich people, but I don't know. Also, he says at one point when after he's broken out of his cell, I'm not a murderer. What about those stormtroopers back there? I don't think see any of them getting
they
back
don't
up.
Count. They don't count. They can't aim for anything.
Right. They had red togas. Okay.
Yep. So, yep.
I don't know. I just thought.
I can see that. But to me, Ben-Hur, I mean, the idea is it's supposed to be kind of a redemption arc for him. He starts off as a spoiled rich kid who can sort of tolerate Rome. And then I got to say his sudden hatred of Rome sort of comes out of nowhere.
You mean in the beginning of the film? Or?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know because like we haven't seen the intervening years since they used to bonk out behind the woodshed. But
they just hung around and threw spears together. I mean, they hung around and went on and rode horseback. Oh, crap.
They picked up their long shafts and... Okay.
thrust them into the yielding wood.
Yes. Am I wrong? No, I am not.
No, you're really not.
I mean, he comes back basically a Nazi, right? Because that's the idea. That's the parallel we're supposed to draw from this. He comes home, yeah, and hey, you know what? The Aryan race is pretty cool. Am I right? Am I right? Oh, mm-hmm. I forgot. You're Jewish. You're not really Jewish. You're only, you know, blah, blah,
you're
blah.
You're one of the good, you might as well just say you're one of the good ones.
Or how about the 10 seconds he actually wears a yarmulke? How about that?
Yeah, and when he does the most unconvincing bracha blessing before the meal.
Hey, you should eat this.
No, it's Baruch Atah Adonai,
my mother.
Yes. Enjoy the fruits of the vine, my mother.
I mean, if he was smarter, he would have stayed in Rome and used his newfound identity, power, and money to help the Jews. But he's like, no, I'm turning away from that. It's bad. And it's like, it's only bad if you use it for badness, you moron.
He gets very, very hyper-focused. He gets some... You know, he's obsessed. That's the idea. He doesn't even... You get the feeling he's not so worried about his family. He just wants to kill Messala.
Yeah.
And the odd part is he doesn't. No, well, he doesn't.
I mean...
He hurts him. He runs over the...
It's true. You know, the ponies kill Messala.
The horses kill Messala. And the wheels of the chariot, they grind his legs up.
Well, that's because Messala's chariot had those little James Bond tire shredder things.
Yes, which is apparently a feature of some Greek chariots. My question is, why did only he have them?
Because he's
bad. Get why Ben-Hur, because Ben-Hur, maybe he did, that's probably something you have to practice with, you have to know about. None of the other racers thought, you know what would be a good idea? Swords on my wheels!
Well, and the funny thing is if you looked at the way that the chariots were made and the team of horses, there's really no point when those chariots should have been able to get close enough to do that because the horses are way wider than the chariot is. So
yeah, they cleaned that up. They're not supposed to use them on the wheels of the chariot. They're supposed to use them on the horses.
Okay. That the horses don't spin.
No, but they, if you cut a horse's legs out from under it, they kind of stop.
Oh.
Yeah. Put the spinning
blades, No, I thought you knew that horses didn't spin, Max. I gave you more credit than that. Horses don't spin.
Well, they could if you tied them to a big enough wheel.
And I have to give you some points. This is a film of its time. And in 1959, obviously, this was a thing because it won 11 Academy Awards. And people went and saw this 3-hour and 42-minute film, and all six and a half minutes of its first overture, and then I forget how many minutes of
it. It's like 10 minutes of the intermission.
Well, people had to go. Yeah. You know,
they did. Yeah, badly, I did by then.
Yeah,
but and also I'm kind of impressed that they had Jewish characters who were good guys.
I mean, if you missed the word where they said they're Jewish, you wouldn't have known.
Oh, no. Some of them were wearing them little beanies.
Like two of them.
Two of them were wearing little beanies,
and they didn't wear them for long. Even Sam Jaffe takes his off, which like...
But they do show respect for the mezuzah.
Okay.
That's that little tablet outside the house.
Oh, what I was wondering about, what is that? Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, the mezuzah, it is a small case, usually sometimes ceramic, nowadays more likely metal or plastic. We have a little rolled up scroll that is a specific set of prayers blessing the house. I think one's from Deuteronomy. I can't remember where the other one's from. And it is both to bless the house and to remind you of the presence of God in the home.
Oh.
And the tradition is anytime you walk in or out, you kiss your hand and you touch the mezuzah, showing respect.
Okay. I did wonder about that because I didn't know anything about that. Well, thank you for letting us know.
Sure. I do have to say when he wins the race and, you know, Pontius is like, I'm upset. I kind of like that. And I kind of like how he's like, look, you're a god to them. I didn't think he was going to be reasonable to him. I thought, well, we're going to have to do something about you.
Well, he's doing something about somebody else. So why doesn't he?
Yeah. And I got to say, Pontius Pilate's throne room. Nice.
Yeah.
I also have to say, I am concerned about all the use of purple because you're not supposed to use purple in Rome unless you are actually a member of the royal family. I don't think a governor gets to do that.
No.
And I'm not positive. Hey, anybody out there know Roman history? Let me know if I'm wrong.
Although we do get to see Tiberius Caesar, who, not the imposing figure I was thinking he might be.
They did kind of go downhill after Jules.
Yeah. What else you got?
The lepers.
Sure.
That is the cleanest set of leprosy I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean, leprosy is a horrific disease and does real terrible damage to people. It's now called Hansen's syndrome, and it is curable if you catch it early. The part nobody seemed to get is it's actually pretty difficult. As you said, it's not easy to catch.
No.
Standing near someone isn't a way to get it. Now, doing what Ben-Hur is doing, of, you know, wrapping himself around Mom and Sis, I really kind of hope that he got caught in the area effect of the cure disease spell.
I heard the D20 in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, it is something that it is transferable by people. They do believe that it is airborne, but it's exposure that's repeated close exposure. So them being in a solitary cell, I don't get it, because whatever. And the only person who could have it is the jailkeeper, and he didn't. So, and also, why didn't he get it? Because he kind of, I mean, he didn't really have exposure, but it's
no
like,
one ever knew.
It was just a plot convenience, and it was just annoying because of the specific disease. It's like, well, we know what happens here. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, because that's the one that we specifically know goes around curing.
Now, to be fair, there are various levels of the disease expressing itself. Some of it is actually not that bad, and some of it is horrible, up to and including losing body parts, etc., etc. Oh,
yeah. There's a line that the Sheik uses, which I think is a quote from something else, but I always liked it. He's talking about Balthazar, and yes, it's that Balthazar, one of the three wise men, who normally is portrayed as black, by the way.
Curry,
at least
curry.
Dark
French
skin. Yeah, no, British all the way. He was the dad in Ivanhoe. But he has a line, Balthazar is a good man, but until all men are like him, we must keep our swords bright. I like that. I think that's a real, it's like, yeah, it's nice, he's a great guy, but until everyone's really great, I'm going to be ready to fight when I have to. That's pretty much what I got.
Well, we should get to the ending, because as of now, this is the longest show we've ever had, which, to be fair, it's the longest movie we've ever done.
This is the longest movie.
Yeah, but so let's get to that part.
The finish.
So, Mike.
Oh, I was caught by surprise.
Ha ha, I fooled you.
I fooled you.
I fooled you.
You'd never seen this.
No.
Except for the chariot scene.
Yes, law.
I think I have an idea here, but what did you think of it?
Not a fan, but here's the thing. It's so much a movie of its time. It is a film that obviously very much impressed in the 1950s. That being said, the level of melodrama is huge and deep. Everything that happens to somebody that's bad is melodramatically bad. The prison cell isn't just a prison cell. It's this horrible sewer that, quite honestly, nobody would have lasted 5 years in. I'm sorry. He gets on the ship and he's in the bottom of the ship and he's blah, blah, blah. It's like everything is just so over the top. Charlton Heston's acting is terrible, which is not a surprise. So the pacing is very slow. It telegraphs every major plot point. There was not a single surprise in this. I do wonder at the, well, there's this interesting story going on over there, but we're going to follow this fake Jewish guy. How about that? It's an interesting idea. But this is prime golden age of Hollywood. It's nearly, it's pretty much the end of the golden age of Hollywood, but I would still put it right in the middle of it.
I think it's solidly in there, yeah.
It is Hollywood throwing everything it can into a production. It's shot in location. They built the damn stadium. There was no little, you know, stop motion ponies, although there were tiny little boats.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a big name of the time. I don't think much of his acting, but he was a big name of the time. The color is amazing. It's very well shot. Great
camera
work.
Beautiful to look at.
But I do not think it is for modern audiences at all. I think it's just, it's like convincing people to watch silent films. Sure, there's a charm to them because of what they are for their time. I question the main character. It's like, I don't think he's that great a guy, quite honestly, and I don't really see his redemption. He doesn't help Jeebus off the pole, does he? No. He doesn't really do anything.
Tries
in
to
the
give
end.
Him a drink.
Sure. Okay, he literally repays the favor that the guy did for him, and that's it. So I'm not going to vote for it, but I also can see why it holds the place that it does.
Okay.
Max, what did you think?
I think this is an amazing movie. It is absolutely a creature of its time. The values are strange. The style of acting is very much of the 50s. It is melodramatic. I think it's gorgeous to look at. I think for the most part, it moves along fairly well, given its obscene length. I don't think much of Charlton Heston either, but he's kind of a placeholder. He's just this thing that everything else happens around.
If you don't have a Jew, you have this.
Exactly. There you go, Crypto Jew.
Mm-hmm. Gods.
I think it's fascinating from a cinematic historical perspective. Just the way it's shot, the way it's done, the way you can see how it's influenced so many other films.
Star Wars.
It's still Star Wars. Hell, The Simpsons make fun of it a couple of times.
The Simpsons have made fun of everything. If we have not been something they've made fun of yet, I'm amazed.
Simpsons did it! But yes, there are true, but a lot of people have utilized this movie in a lot of different ways. There have been so many, MGM broke down the sets and sold them off. It cost them $150,000 to do it. You know why? Because if they had left them in Rome, they were afraid there would have been about 50 cheap Italian ripoffs of the movie.
Might have been more fun.
Only if they had Italian Spider-Man in them.
George Reeves.
I think it's a remarkable movie.
Steve Reeves.
Don't go into it expecting a modern movie's sensibilities or pacing. And yes, the acting is kind of hack. And it's not like there wasn't good acting in the 50s.
No.
There certainly was better. I'm not a fan of Charlton Heston either. Like I say, apart from his role in Hamlet, he does the same thing every time. He's just, okay, Chuck, can you clench for 2 hours?
Wasn't the name of his autobiography Trying to Poop? I think it was.
I think so. So, we got a bit of a disagreement. I say it's worth seeing only just for its place in history.
Yeah, I got better things to do with 4 hours of my time. You know what one of those things is? Answering our poll question. Max, could you go over that again, please? Hey, that's one of my
But I'm not going to.
Yes, I kid.
This time, we'd like to know, when you hear that a movie is a multi-Oscar winner, like this one, does that influence your desire to see it, and does it do it positively or negatively? And you can tell us the answer by emailing us directly, as Mr. O'Lading does, at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can go to our website, which coincidentally, or is it, is maxmikemovies.com, and leave a comment. You can also make suggestions for the series, suggestions for other series, ideas for our 400th episode, please.
Yeah.
Something. Yes, you can do all of that. You can also find us on social mediocrity, such as
Blue Sky and Facebook.
Thank you. And we are on virtually every podcast that has ever been conceived or will ever be conceived throughout the history of the universe. We're that good. And you can be like my little desert flower, Doris Hempelmeyer, and call our hotline to leave a message.
617-398-7266. That number again is 617-398-7266.
Thank you, Mike. But we are just getting started with this tops and bottoms. I still don't see why everyone's laughing.
Ask Charlton. No, don't ask Charlton. Ask Masala. He knows.
Yeah. So, Mike, what is the other end of the spectrum we're going to be watching next week? What was the bomb, or even the bomb diggity, of 1959? I don't know. I heard about it somewhere.
Interestingly, when I first proposed this, it seemed like a pretty easy idea. We'll take the top grossing, the bottom grossing. Well, it seems that, especially back in the 50s anyway, they weren't that good at keeping records, so nobody would fess up as to who made the least amount of money. So this is going to be a very fluid choice. Mm-hmm. On one hand, they say that there is a big bomb of another biblical epic called The Big Fisherman. Never heard it, but basically it's been buried and people don't, or Hollywood, I guess, doesn't want people to see it. I'm not sure if it's out there at all. There was another one called The Miracle that also did poorly during that year. I wonder if this is one of those situations where, hey, you hear what's his name is making a big picture. We should make the same thing and come out 6 months early. You know, like they used to do with The Abyss and stuff like that.
And they still do all the time, yes.
On another hand, we might take some real low box office performers like Killer Shrews or Attack of the Giant Leeches.
Oh, dear.
But I decided to pick a film that was a surprising disappointment.
Ooh.
And it comes from a very large studio that was not known for making disappointing films, or at least disappointingly performing films.
Yeah.
And that film is 1959's Sleeping Beauty. This film lost...
Now, wait a sec. When you say Sleeping Beauty, you mean like one of those cheap ripoffs they did by like
Disney.
A Russian film crew Disney. Or a Disney. I don't think I know them. That's
Walt Disney.
That's two words, right?
Disney,
like this knee.
Yep.
The Walt Disney Studios.
Yeah.
That lost
Sleeping
money.
Beauty. And one of the, apparently one of the complaints was it was not a movie that was really made for children. Here's the thing.
Why, just because it actually invokes hell at one point?
I mean, it's got a cool dragon in it.
It's got the one of the coolest Disney villains ever.
Well, and she did get her own film eventually, which I did not see, even though it had Angelina Jolie in it. So, yeah, apparently one of the biggest disappointments of 1959 was Sleeping Beauty. So let's find out next week if it disappoints us here on Max Mike Movies.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.